This is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Arlene McMichael. The National Wildlife Federation has released the first of two videos on the Kalamazoo River oil spill in 2010. Coming up, Gordon Evans talks with pipeline specialist Beth Wallace about it. But first, I interview Dr. David Anzell, author of The Death Gap, who has been a physician at both affluent and less affluent hospitals in Chicago. He says that led him to write a book about how class inequities and what he calls structural racism are causing ongoing and wide disparities in the quality of health between white and brown people, and how the trend can be reversed. Dr. Anzell will be in Kalamazoo on June 6 to deliver a free public talk at the Western Michigan University Homer Stryker MD School of Medicine. He says good health care should be a human right. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can you please tell us a little bit about your background?
Yes, I'm a general internist, a primary care physician. I trained in upstate New York and then came to train at Cook County Hospital in Chicago, the legendary public hospital. And I was there for 17 years and then moved to Mount Sinai Hospital, an urban safety net institution, literally a half mile down the street. And for the last 11 years, I've been at Rush University Medical Center, an academic medical center, where I was chief medical officer. And currently, I'm senior vice president for community health equity.
So you're really quite an expert on inner city health issues. You just released a book called The Death Gap, How Inequity Kills. Tell us about that book.
Yes, I wrote that book because I spent almost 40 years on one street in Chicago at three different hospitals, and I call it One Street, Two Worlds, because not only were the experiences of the institutions different, what it was like to be at a sort of fancy, high-tech academic medical center like I am now versus a public hospital or an urban safety net hospital, but also the experience of the patients were different. And it was through my experiences and through the eyes of my patients that I wrote The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills. And because in my observation, the patients didn't just have different lifestyles, they had different lives, and those lives were predicated by the concentration of poverty and disadvantage into communities. And that concentration of disadvantage also affected the institutions that served them. So things were just out of reach. They weren't available. And as a result, people died, and they died early.
Three different hospitals on the same street. You worked at all three of those hospitals?
Yes.
Are you suggesting that those three different hospitals, the care differed in each one of those?
The care differed, and the care differed because the same issues that impoverish communities actually create the situations where we have an unequal healthcare system, that hospitals and clinics that serve poor people in general around the country, while doctors and nurses who go there do great work, and I don't want to minimize the work, and I'm not saying people's lives don't get saved, but compared to what's available in our fanciest hospitals that serve in oftentimes the wealthiest populations, those with the better insurance, care is different. I'll give you an example.
Again, just to clarify, of those three hospitals, you're saying one or two of them tended to serve more poor people compared to the other?
Two of them were safety net hospitals, meaning mm-hmm. they served predominantly poor and uninsured mm-hmm. Folks as part of their mission. The third one I'm at right now, Rush University Medical Center, fantastic academic medical center. Everything you would want in biomedicine is available at your fingertips. Those things were not available. Let me give you a crystal clear example. In 27 years at the public hospital, Cook County, and at Mount Sinai Hospital, where I was chair of medicine, not one of my patients ever got a transplant. For example, when their organ failed, they just never could get a transplant because there were not the doctors on staff nor the ability to do transplants. However, the patients that were in those trauma units, often people of color and uninsured, provided the organs that got transplanted at a place like my hospital now, Rush, literally a half mile down the street. Another example, I was on the board of the public hospital, and the chief medical officer came over to speak to me one day, and I was chairing the quality committee, and he said, David, the wait list for the eye clinic at the public hospital, Cook County, was so long that people went blind on the waiting list. And literally across the street at my hospital, you could get to see the eye doctor the same day. And what differentiated these institutions were, one, the people they served. The public hospital and the safety net hospital served mostly poor and uninsured patients, so they just did not have the same access to care, whereas my hospital serves, you know, those who have the right cards. And while we take care of some uninsured, it's a different so-called payer mix, and that payer mix tends to favor, the wealthy and the wealthier over the poor, and it's just different care.
Maybe you can explain this to me. I understand about people being uninsured, but if someone was needing a transplant or any other type of help, could they not get a referral, or they tend not to do that in these public hospitals?
Well, one is there are many, many uninsured. It's gotten better under the Affordable Care Act, which is under attack right now. It's gotten better, and some of these people can get coverage. But it turns out that in places like Illinois, there are a million uninsured even after the Affordable Care Act, many of them undocumented, and they don't have access. Some people couldn't actually traverse the neighborhood from going literally half mile to down to the next hospital. But oftentimes, the access to these patients was blocked because the institutions don't take the insurance card. It turns out that when you look at something like transplants, people who are on Medicaid, people who are uninsured, people who are black and brown have less access to transplant lists. And it turns out that hospitals that are serve mostly black and brown populations, and these are populations that tend to have higher rates of uninsurance, tend to be lower quality and have less access to specialists and specialty care. And so there's a complex web of reasons why people don't access care, but it all comes down to what card you have and whether the place you're being referred to takes that card.
I know that your book talks about health outcomes are determined by kind of where people live and things like that. Talk a little bit about that. Some doctors like to say that certain things have to do with race, that maybe it's because you have this race that you might have this health problem, but you're saying that it's bigger than that.
Yes, it's bigger than that. Let me just sort of give the listeners a visual, and I'm going to of Chicago, but this could be any city or any place in the country. If you're downtown Chicago, which I'm sure many of your listeners have been to, at the Loop, right by the lakefront, life expectancy is 85 years old. If that were a country, it would be ranked number one in the world in life expectancy. Think Japan. But go literally seven stops down the blue line, the L track, into the community where my prior hospital was, Mount Sinai, and life expectancy plummets to under 69 years. It's literally three stops from my current hospital. And think Bangladesh, and the life expectancy in this Garfield Park neighborhood is lower than the life expectancy in Bangladesh. And these are due to the fact that poverty is concentrated in these neighborhoods. And you say, well, why is poverty concentrated in these neighborhoods? Because actually they were actively segregated by federal laws back in the 1960s and the 1970s that prevented black and brown people from moving into more affluent white neighborhoods, a condition that still exists today. and the wealth was expropriated from these neighborhoods. So the deindustrialization of these neighborhoods, an active process of moving plentiful jobs out, first to the suburbs, then to the south, and now they've been moved overseas. And this problem of concentrated disadvantage or cumulative disadvantage actually shortens lifespan. You can throw all the doctors in the world at it, but without jobs and without income and education, people cannot thrive. And indeed, in many of these neighborhoods, they don't thrive as they do in wealthier neighborhoods.
And how would you say a lack of income and inadequate education is affecting health? Connect the dots.
Well, you know, it turns out that the number one correlate of life expectancy of who lives longer in this whole country is education and income. There's huge income inequality in this country. Let me give you an example. If you're wealthy in this country, not wealthy, but if you're making like above a middle-class income rate in this country, let's say above $50,000, $60,000 a year, you doesn't matter where you live in the country, you have the opportunity to live a full and rich life because you have access to many things, good food, perhaps a safe neighborhood, a job that pays decently, the ability to send your kids to school, et cetera, et cetera. But when you're poor, where you live makes a huge difference. And there's a 15-year life expectancy gap between the poor and the rich, and the poor and those who are better off in this country. It's not just rich people. And that gap varies depending on where you live. So if you live in San Francisco or New York, that gap is you get five more years in life expectancy than you live in, say, the South or Detroit, for example. So where you live when you're poor makes a huge difference in how long you will live. And this is premature mortality. This is people dying before the age of 65. And when men die, which is predominantly what's happening in this country, when men die prematurely, that's a real loss of wealth for families and communities. And these communities go into a spiral. And the deindustrialization, first in the inner cities, but now across white America, has led to a phenomenon where white people without college degrees are dying at an unprecedented rate prematurely, just like black people in inner city areas have been doing for the past, you know, hundreds of years. It's a national phenomenon, and it's gotten a lot of attention because the United States is the only country, developed country in the world, where life expectancy is dropping amidst all this prosperity. It's as if we have two countries, the country for those who have more, and a very, very different distressed nation for those who have less. And it's affecting really the ability of people to live long and healthy lives.
When I hear you say that, this is what I draw from this, and I don't know if this is what you're getting at, which is that what's happening, you're saying that white people who now are not having as much education are experiencing some of the same health outcomes as some people of color. So does this also kind of support your idea that it's more kind of these, you know, you have if you have less stress, if you have a better diet, if you have access to better health care and those types of things, that you'll have better outcomes regardless of your race?
Yes. So this wasn't so much about race as much as it was about racism and policies that perpetuated what I call structural racism. I say the cause of the premature mortality, both in the black population and now in the white population, is something I call structural violence. It's the way that our policies, our procedures, our laws, our rules of society have disadvantaged people to such a degree that they in their own personal agency, cannot lift themselves out. So if you look at the growing income inequality in the United States, and the loss of jobs and well-paying jobs, like I said, first from urban areas and inner city areas, then you know, actually totally out of the country. It's left people without the ability to earn incomes that allow them to live the lives that are going to lead to good health and longer life expectancy. And this cumulative disadvantage, I think, driven by this wide income inequality. There's more impoverished neighborhoods in the United States now than there were in the 1960s. Child poverty in this country is at astronomical levels, and we can reverse it. There are things we know we can do to ameliorate life expectancy. You know, it turns out that black life expectancy in this country continues to rise. It's always lagged white life expectancy. But for the first time, this white life expectancy has actually dropped for non-college educated women and men. And the number of deaths is more than the AIDS epidemic in the 1990s. It's a tragic, distressing and actually avoidable and reversible phenomenon.
I'd like us to talk about solutions, but before we get there, there's another point that I think that you make that is unique to people of color when it comes to the healthcare system, and that is bias in the medical staff in terms of how they treat people of color as patients.
Right. I actually think a good way to look at structural violence is the systematic, repetitive ways in which the way that we act, both as a society, as individuals, disadvantage one group over another. And in the United States of America, the structural racism is an important lens with which to look at outcomes, and particularly health outcomes. How does structural racism work? Well, when we have policies and procedures that advantage whites over people of color, that is structural racism. Let me give you an example of how it works. I mentioned one before, that it turns out that the hospitals that serve brown and black people in this country, largely because of the way we've decided to organize insurance, are poorer quality hospitals. They're more likely to be ranked one or two stars than hospitals that serve predominantly white individuals in the United States that are more likely to be five- and four-star hospitals. And even a white person who goes to a predominantly minority hospital has worse health outcomes, and that's structural. It's not about race. It's about racism that disadvantages not only black and brown people, but white people who come in contact with these system. So that's one example. Two, there's bias. So there's ways in which
implicit bias.
I'm going to say there's explicit and implicit bias. Mm-hmm. So, but let's take explicit out for a second and talk about implicit bias. The way that our brains react when we have someone in front of us who's different, we make assumptions, and those unconscious assumptions can lead to differences in treatment. Let me give you an example. Some people posit that the increasing life expectancy, the decreasing life expectancy among whites, there's a large component of opioid overdose, has not as much affected the black and brown population because white doctors are less likely to prescribe opioids for pain management for black and brown people. And this may have actually protected black and brown people from the ravages of the opioid epidemic, whereas white people are more likely to get prescribed opioids for pain. So there's ways in which we provide different treatments based on race. And there's huge literature in the medical literature that doctors have this implicit bias, that they offer different kinds of treatments for blacks and whites. In fact, there was a famous report in 2002 called Unequal Treatment that actually, by the Institute of Medicine, that lays out all of the ways in which black and brown people get unequal treatment in American healthcare. Much of it implicit bias.
Is there a country or countries that you think are getting it right in terms of healthcare?
Yeah. So the other side of it is how do you begin to solve a problem like this? One of the ways, we've had historical injustices in this country. Structural racism is one of those historical injustices, but it's more of an injustice if we perpetuate it into the future. And there are countries that have done better with this. For example, if you're Costa Rica has a universal health care program, you have it from birth. And it turns out that if you're poor in Costa Rica, you do way better in terms of life expectancy than if you're poor in the United States. But our country to the north, our neighbor to the north, Canada, has a universal health care, single-payer system, a Medicare for all system that has actually improved life expectancy. In this country, in the United States, life expectancy at the age of 50, there's a giant gap between the wealthiest 20% of the country and the poorest 20% of the country, and that gap has grown since 1980. You don't see such a great gap between the wealthiest and the poor in Canada with regard to life expectancy. So we know a single-payer Medicare for all healthcare system where everybody gets the exact same card, they can go wherever they want for their care, actually leads to better outcomes. Because right now we have an apartheid healthcare system based on payer. It segregates people by their card system, where the poor, the uninsured, those with Medicaid actually receive different care, have different access to the healthcare system, and a single payer like Canada or Costa Rica has, and actually 30 developed countries have, is a much better solution to the problem.
I'm just curious on one point. I'm getting your point about the universal health care, but in Canada, I know they have quite a bit of diversity there. I was just curious, has there been any data in terms of while overall health outcomes are better, is there any differentiation among the different races and cultures in Canada?
Well, this you raise a very good question. Anytime you have giant gradients in income, you're going to have life expectancy and health gaps. That's a fact of the world. And that's why reducing inequality through various means makes a difference. We did a study, though, of Toronto and Chicago, and we looked at low birth weight babies. And we looked at black and white, and we looked at the income gradient, rich and poor. And this was out of our Center for Community Health Equity here in Chicago, with our colleagues from DePaul University. And here's what we found, that if you were well off, and I'm not talking super rich, but if you were well off in Toronto or Chicago, your chance of having a low birth weight baby was very low, about 3%, and it didn't matter where you live. But if you were poor in Chicago, there was up to a 20% chance of having a low birth weight baby. And in Toronto, it was about half that, 10%. But in Chicago, there was a race and income gradient. The poorer you were, the blacker you were black versus white, ended up having a higher chance of having a low birth weight baby. We didn't see the same income race gradient in Toronto. And when asked for why that was, the answer was universal health care, one. Two, when a pregnant woman is in trouble, like homeless or something in Toronto, there's better social services. And three, there's universal access to education, which allows anyone of any means to actually climb the opportunity ladder. So we know that while disparities exist in a place like Canada and Toronto, they're not as wide, it's not as wide a chasm as they are in the United States. And I talk about this in A Death Gap, How Inequality Kills.
Are you concerned about the changes to the Affordable Care Act?
So I think the Affordable Care Act didn't go far enough. Like I said, I'm a proponent for universal health care. A single-payer type like Canada has as a much better and fairer solution. That said, the Affordable Care Act insured about additional 20 million people. And one of the big things that it did was offer for those states who expanded Medicaid, low Medicaid insurance for poor people who were otherwise ineligible. What the Republicans are proposing will dismantle the system. It's an $800 billion transfer of wealth, expropriation of wealth from the poor in the United States to the top 1 and 2% of the population. If this bill goes through, it'll be devastating. Mind you, after the Affordable Care Act, there were about 30 million uninsured left in this country. We hadn't solved the uninsured problem. And I told you all the problems I have with Medicaid because people don't have the same access, but people do have some access to care, and it's much better than having no insurance. So the Republican proposals will gouge, devastate, destroy all of the gains on the Affordable Care Act, and literally will kill people. For every million people uninsured in this country, 1,000 people die each year. And so if 24 million people lose their insurance, that means 24,000 additional deaths. And to say nothing about those who are maimed and hurt and ill as a result of not having access to care.
In our last few minutes, let's focus on solutions. You talked about universal health care. You said that's something that you propose. It looks like that's not exactly what we're getting here in America. But what would be your top three or four solutions to making things better for health care for brown and black people in America?
Right. Well, I think we need to, one, resist the changes in the Affordable Care Act. And this is means everyone who's listening, this is time to call folks up and say, resist these changes because it's going to set the country back. But at the same time, we have to look ahead to a fairer system. And I think right now people are beginning to think that health care is a human right. And just like marriage equality or women's right to vote, we've had to fight for our rights. So people need to roll up their sleeves, get on the phone, elect people to office who believe that healthcare is a human right. So that's number one. Number two is many of these problems of life expectancy don't actually directly have to do with healthcare. It has to do with people's employment and income and wealth creation. We have actively disinvested in this country, especially in our infrastructure. We've actually deindustrialized in active ways, not only in urban areas, but in rural areas. And we need a Marshall Plan for our country where we reinvest in these neighborhoods. Because when we reinvest in neighborhoods that bring jobs and well-paying jobs, people can thrive. And these early deaths in America, the only developed country in the world with the kind of premature mortality that we see, are a signal of a society that's rotten in its core, but we can fix it with reinvestment in these neighborhoods. And three, I will say access to universal education. So we need to allow, and I know you do something in Kalamazoo where I've heard where if you graduate from high school in Kalamazoo, you can go to college. And we need to make access to higher education a right as well, not just secondary education, because in this day and age, a secondary education, a high school education, doesn't afford you the ladder to a long and healthy life. And so those would be three prescriptions I would have. I'm a big believer that health and the right to health is a human right. It's not something we've agreed to on this country, and for that reason, we've got a lot of work ahead of us. And I hope people read The Death Gap, How Inequality Kills, because it really talks about how we got here and does give solutions to the problem.
We've been speaking with Dr. David Enzel, who will talk about health disparities and structural racism on June 6 at the Western Michigan University Homer Stryker MD School of Medicine. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Earlene McMichael.